Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Season 4 of Food Conversations. Now, before we begin, we acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepnik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, today we're delighted to welcome into our studio two guests who are very much part of the expanding relocalizing process in the Shuswap. Alison Round is the cider maker for and co-owner of the North Yards Cider Company, and Gavin Wright is North Yards Orchard Manager. Welcome, Alison and Gavin.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's terrific to have you in the studio. The studio is a place where you can really kind of connect. Zoom has got its place. It's served its purpose, but we're happy to be bypassing Zoom today. Now, listeners will be aware of the fact that everyone who's come on our show so far has reached their current role in life through a relatively circuitous route, which is what all normal people do, and our guests today are no exception. Now, if you believe the television ads, Canada is more conventionally a beer country with a parallel propensity for wine, but each of our guests has a particular cider story to tell. So maybe we can start off finding out how, for each of you, cider first came onto your radar. Gavin, why don't you go first and tell us that little nugget?
Okay, how did cider first come onto my radar? Well, I have for a long time been a local food aficionado and passionate about local food systems. I sort of doing, you know, DIY sort of things. And so I have brewed beer in the past. I have been a passionate grower of vegetables and fruits, and always sort of had a goal of, or an ultimate goal would be to grow perennial tree fruits like apples, and then to also make cider out of those apples, because it's such a rewarding process where you're going directly from the land and from the trees, and making a product with essentially one ingredient, and then you have your byproduct, your apple mush, and your trimmings that you can compost that go back to the trees, and so it's just a nice little closed loop system, and you have a beautiful beverage out of it.
Alison, what was your first brush with cider and something that got you interested in it?
For me, I have been interested in cider for about 15 years now. I'm not a beer person by any stretch of the imagination. That was running.
Bypassed that.
Yeah, I did.
Icon.
At 18, that was it. I'd had a six pack once then, and that was it. And then I actually didn't drink for a really long time. I didn't really enjoy wine. I wasn't into beer, and then any of the other beverages that were out there didn't really pique my interest. So 15 years ago, I had the opportunity to go to a beer fest down in Bellingham. Lots of people know this story, but there were 48 breweries and 2 craft cideries that were there. And for me at that time, I didn't know what craft cider meant. My perception was that it was just, in a 2-liter plastic bottle, and that it was overly sugared. So although being at this beer fest, all my friends were having a ton of fun getting drunk, I didn't want to be left behind. So I thought, okay, I'll have to drink this cider. But what came from that was it actually blew my mind. The craft cider was the best thing that I'd ever tasted in my life, and then actually in my life. So from that moment on, my partner Kathleen and I, we looked for great cider after that. And then eventually I fell into trying to make it at home. And then eventually we started the cidery.
And now it's serious.
Yeah. Now it's serious. Yeah. Now it's the big show.
Now, Alison, you grew up in Stony Plain, a little town of about 10,000 outside Edmonton. then moved to Vancouver after high school. But before you did that, you learned something from your grandparents and their cattle farming operation that stayed with you for life. Tell the listeners about that.
Well, yeah, I've been a vegan for 27 years now. My grandparents, yes, had a cattle farm, and being a part of a farming family, everyone pitches in. That I truly believe that a great work ethic really comes from working on a farm and pitching in. And so I got a great work ethic out of it, but also I was pretty grossed out as well. So from that, basically the time that I was 17 on, I lost the want to eat any kind of meat at that point.
The appetite for meat.
Yep.
And along the way, over the next few years, you actually took a course in holistic nutrition.
I did, yeah. And part of that was just because, you know, you can be vegetarian, you can be vegan, but unless you have some knowledge about what's the proper way of being able to feed yourself, you might find yourself, you know, down the road being in trouble from choosing a particular, you know, food lifestyle that doesn't actually feed you.
You also picked up a skill in one of the many jobs that you worked at, that's a very important mechanical skill, and that's operating a forklift.
It's true. Yeah. That's one of those things where I truly believe that as long as you decide the job that you are, that you've set yourself up within, that that's something that you would like to spend your time being at. So for me, that was, I was working at a natural foods warehouse, and I believe in natural foods. And so although I wasn't making a natural food, I was packing it off to go off to Whole Foods and Choices and other places like that. But I worked in this warehouse, and I learned how to drive a forklift. So that was 4 years of being able to do that. But, you know, I walked away from that job when I was 30 thinking, well, I guess I'll never do that again. But that was not the case. It actually came in handy, like so
tight
handy.
Tight corners.
Oh, totally. Once we got into our new space in Squamish, I had an inch between the forks and an inch between the butt of the forklift. And had I not had that experience, I'm pretty sure I would have destroyed most of my equipment. Yeah.
Not only that, another job that you had for 11 years, which was working the post office, helped you understand that that wasn't the kind of work you wanted to do.
That's right. Yeah. I had my goal every day while I delivered the mail was to basically spend time trying to figure out what it was that I was actually meant to be doing.
That's a human dilemma that every one of us in this room and listening to this show has faced. And thank you for outlining it so clearly. Now, Gavin, your background was quite different. Your father's an academic pharmacologist, and you grew up in Montreal, which is one major metropolitan center. And then you moved to another major metropolitan center in Vancouver. So I guess it's not surprising that you went on to school, to university at Simon Fraser, and you did a BA in communications. But that's where you got involved with a project that I think it's fair to say really changed your perspective, to do with seeds. That really influenced you. What was that like?
Yeah, so as you said, I did. I mean, I was very much a city kid, and I mean, my mom was a passionate gardener, and so I certainly experienced eating, you know, carrots fresh out of the garden, and that sort of thing, and rhubarb, and but I was definitely, I didn't have at all the farm background and the farm work ethic that Allison described. That was not my. I didn't play in the hay as my kid does now, So at university, I was doing communications, as you said, and I did a certificate program in sustainable community development, and had an opportunity to do an in-depth project on basically examining a nonprofit organization called the Planting Seeds Project, I believe it was called. And so we got to go and interview the leaders of this operation, and they had a farm out in Lytton, and we went out to Lytton and actually spent a night at the farm and checked it out, and just speaking to them and seeing what they were doing, it really was like a light went on in my head, and I said, well, this is what I want to do. This is exciting. This is where I want to go. And I was right at the end of my degree, and of course, having zero experience in farming or food systems other than this experience at university, I searched around and eventually ended up at UBC Farm, which was a student-run farm that's still there at UBC.
It's the only working farm in the city limits of Vancouver. And I had to learn that because of another project, but it's astonishing. And it was often tried to convert it into something else, like high-rise apartment buildings. And thank God they never did, because it's a wonderful place. So did you fall in love with getting your hands dirty when you were there?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, I mean, what I know is that I have always been a sort of a hands-on learner. And I just wouldn't have known how to express that, you know, when I was in school, and probably a lot of my teachers weren't even trained in that. And so to sort of discover that and explore that at UBC Farm and then beyond, you know, it really was like, it was like coming home, right? It's like, oh, this is what I've been missing.
And you were working on a master's in sustainable food systems at the same time that you were deeply connected to the UBC Farm. So you had the academic and the hands-on side by side.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I was building Cobb, and so that's like a natural building with just using clay sand and straw. We had a project, and so I had volunteers that were just sticking their feet in the mud and then building, and an inch a day is sort of the tagline for Cobb, right? I mean, that's a good day.
A lot of contemplation. another inch. Mm.
But the farm, UBC Farm, is very well used by not only the land and food systems or agriculture faculty, but a lot of the faculties at UBC, and
community groups as well.
And community groups, yeah, and even more so now. But I had a prof, Alejandro Rojas, who came down with his class, and I took them on a little tour, and he was really interested in what I was saying and what I was doing, and he sort of convinced me to do a master's. That wasn't my intention, actually, and I ended up doing more of a theoretical master's and not necessarily a hands-on. It was a great experience, met great people, learned great stuff, but it wasn't actually what I learned how to do research, and I didn't actually want to do research, but I got a master's.
There you are. You are now a master of something.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, you went off to Australia for a while, and you learned some things there that were helpful for you. Why don't you just describe what you picked up there?
Yeah, so I mean, I was in Australia just prior to deciding to go back to university. It was actually while I was traveling that I decided that is what I wanted to do as a mature student. And I think as many, many backpackers who went to Australia, the sort of thing that you do to pick up money is you pick vegetables and fruit, right? So it's you're a migrant worker, essentially, right? So I did that. We camped in an RV park in the mountains in New South Wales and picked apples for more than a month. I think I was up there for five weeks, maybe. It didn't resonate at all at that time as something that I was excited about. But now that I am running the orchard for sure at North Yards, and hiring and working with pickers myself, that's something that I really learned a lot from, of just having that perspective of what it's like to be a picker.
Now, Alison, you also spent some time in Australia early on, you know, when you're relatively young. And it was different, but it was also something, I mean, you came from a town of 10,000, and here you are in across the other side of the world. What was that like for you, just overall?
It was a great experience for me. I was fortunate enough at the time to have family there, so it was a pretty soft landing point for someone who's fresh out of high school, doesn't know what they want to do. It's a safe place. So I kind of bounced a little bit between family there and did a lot of odd jobs there as well. I didn't pick apples, but I did pick bananas for 3 months.
Ah, well, there you are. They're like elongated apples.
Yeah.
Now, when you know, both of you are back sort of in the Canadian context in British Columbia. And Allison, you met Kathleen when you were working at the post office, and you were starting to learn how much you didn't want to have a career in the post office. And then, as we mentioned earlier in the show, you sort of charted this course between the beer camp and the wine camp into the cider camp. And that led to some actual, your sort of academic learning experiences, the Enology and Viticultural School in Walla Walla. That was a special kind of place because of the person who was coming to teach there. Why don't you describe that a bit?
There's this celebrated UK cider maker named Peter Mitchell. He doesn't teach this course anymore, but it's been sort of taken over by... but I think it's the University of Washington and Oregon. But he came over for about, I think, 15 years and taught this course out of Walla Walla. And that was basically, it's like a get-to-know cider kind of course from many facets of, you know, what you might be doing in a cidery and on an orchard. So we spent quite a bit of time learning different things, like, you know, smells around cider and just appreciation for different types of cider. So that was really great for me because, you know, as someone who loves cider, it gave me just the appreciation of being able to try something different. And although it might not be something I drink every day, I could now sort of mentally pick it apart a little bit and then decide what I did or didn't like about it, or, you know, just that kind of thing.
And did it give you sort of a vocabulary to talk about cider? I mean, there's, in medicine, you learn a vast vocabulary of Latin-derived words that nobody else understands, so you sound like you're smart.
Right.
Did you find that you learned how to talk about the things that there are to do with cider, the sort of cider vocabulary?
Yes. However, it is kind of funny because I'm not really great with words. I think I can talk about something for a long time, but I'm not that specific about being able to pinpoint certain words. However, yes, of course, there's like lots of cider-specific vocabulary that you use when you're in, you know, chatting with people about it. You know, fermentation has its own set of uniqueness, and so there's lots of stuff that comes up.
It's obvious you know a lot about cider.
Yeah, I do, but
that's okay. Call it science.
Yes.
Yes.
It's true. We do say all the time we're dropping science every day there.
Science.
Well, you did a little more science with a fellow named Andrew Byers at Washington State. What was that all about?
He's actually the cider maker at Finn River in Chemicum, Washington. And that's an amazing cidery farm, and that guy's just incredible because his beginnings were on the East Coast, and he was working in a winery, and eventually made his way to the West Coast, and just became the cider maker at this at this cidery, and his cider was that very first cider that I'd ever tried at that beer fest. Right. So it was his cider that blew my mind. And because of that, then I sought him out. And then the owners of Finn River allowed me to come for 3 days and hang out with him in the cidery and get an opportunity to you know, walk in his shoes and ask him all the questions that I wanted to know.
So
that was great.
What was it about that experience of drinking cider? You're not a beer drinker, you're not, you know, a drinker particularly at all, but there was something about cider that captured you. Do you know what it was?
For me, I think it's the simplicity of cider. Not dissimilar to wine, because it's literally the same process of making cider as it is for wine, but the alcohol content of wine is a bit too high for me. I'm actually quite a lightweight when it comes to alcohol, and so cider being that beverage that again is so simple and has such interesting complexity. There's 17,000 known varietals of apples, and so there kind of is like no end to the different types of taste of ciders that you can create out there. So I think that's it's so neat, you know.
Well, it clearly is capturing the public's imagination. There are certainly more people and more cideries forming, and we'll talk a little bit about Squamish, because you and Kathleen formulated at some point the idea that you would start making cider yourselves. What was that process like? I mean, that's launching out of an idea into actually doing something, committing time, money.
Time, money,
ongoing barrelfuls of time and money.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So, how did things get? What was the sort of genesis of this plan?
Well, after that beer fest, then a few years went by of just enjoying, as we like to call it, R&D cider. After that, Kathleen, as a lawyer, had a client approach her about starting a brewery. And so she went through the process of working through that with this person for around 6 to 9 months. I can't remember how long it was. And then that opportunity never came to fruition. But, at that time of watching what she was doing to start to get this brewery up, this brewer specifically up and going with his brewery. We spent a lot of time just watching that all happen. And then at the end of that, based on how sad I was working at the post office and how much we loved cider already at that time, then, we just sort of evolved into, well, why not us,
Let's so put your money where your taste buds are.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, lots of people are doing it. Why not us? Hmm. So that is what sort of started the ball rolling.
Meanwhile, Gavin, you were pursuing projects in sustainable food production, and you actually worked as an organic certifier for a number of years. You were going around all over BC. How far over BC did you roam in terms of that particular kind of work?
Yeah, so I was doing organic certification and then inspection, and so I worked as an inspector. I did go up to the Peace, so I went to grain farms in the Peace around Fort St. John and Dawson Creek up there, and over to the Kootenays quite often, and then down to the coast. I did some inspections on big, big, like chocolate making, for example, like organic chocolate warehouse, like a massive warehouse, right? So,
but you weren't drawn away to the chocolate business.
I also had the opportunity to do a lot of the wineries and cideries. I mean, there's only a handful of organic cideries in BC, but I essentially have been to all of them, and so to see the orchard and the full process from the wineries and the and cideries, to see that whole process right through, was something that was really exciting for me. And it was an amazing experience. I really loved being able to go to the different operations and see how they all ran, and be their sort of organic contact.
And that eventually led you, I mean, it really did intrigue you to the point where you actually decided you're going to go into organic farming yourself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had dabbled in organic farming even before that. But it certainly, especially the, you know, that sort of cidery, winery aspect, the idea of having a perennial plant, that you're building a system to grow sort of the best fruit that you can and in the best sort of environment, but then also turn that into a value-added product, was something that was very exciting to me. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, that's, cider making is also very exciting to me, more exciting than just, say, growing apples on their own for the purpose of selling apples.
So you for a couple of years with another couple and your partner at the time, you got into an actual farm. You actually purchased the land and worked on it for a couple of years. And then the world started to turn, as they say on some television shows. And at about 2017, the property that is now Northland Cider Company's property used to belong to Hannah and Hannah, it was the long-standing family here, with an orchard. And in 2017, it went on the market, and you saw it on the market.
I saw it on the market. I even came up because the Hannahs were selling off, you know, some of the things like the Hascap plants and different racks and sort of things. And so I had come up for that, and we had acquired some stuff for our own farm. But immediately when I saw that sign go up, I thought, well, this is an amazing location for a cidery. This needs to be a cidery. if only, you know, I was a gung-ho entrepreneur with all kinds of investors and backing and deep pockets, then I would want to do that.
Meanwhile, the gung-ho entrepreneurs were looming large on the stage as well. Kathleen's aunt and uncle have lived in Salmon Arm for 30 years. And you know, you'd already started a cider company in Squamish, but then you heard about this place, the Hannah and Hannah Orchards, through your, Kathleen's family members here. How did you go from hearing about the property to saying, let's do it?
Yeah, we had been actually down in the Naramata area looking at property at that time. So it was kind of perfect for us because it just so happened to be, in Squamish, we'd been thinking about buying a piece of property. So that's going a couple of years back. The taxation is quite brutal if you're a commercial cider maker. So we thought we need a piece of property. We also want to secure our apples. So we were looking in the Naramata area, and then we eventually got the call from our uncle.
So while you're getting connected to Kathleen's aunt and uncle, Gavin is connecting to a potato farmer in Pemberton. And there's an interesting linkage there. Gavin, why don't you tell us about the potato farmer?
Well, when I had seen the property for sale, I was very excited about the possibility of a cidery there. And then I read in probably the Salmon Arm Observer in a local paper that the property had been purchased by Allison and Kathleen, and that their intention was to move their cidery up there. And so that was very, very exciting for me. And I immediately started, read the website and started looking into it and thought, well, how am I going to get myself into this project?
Because how do I work my way into this situation?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, personally, for me, a big part of that too was this, the inspection work was very solo work. And I was very keen to get back to doing team work.
Sure.
And North Yards has been amazing for that. Mm-hmm. So very exciting for me. Anyway, I eventually found Kathleen and Allison's names on the website, and I started doing, essentially I creeped them out on Facebook. I started looking at their profiles on Facebook, and I saw that Anna Helmer, who's an organic potato farmer in Pemberton, was a mutual friend.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so I reached out to Anna and told her what was going on, and she was also very excited because she said, I know they're excited to be up there and they're fabulous and you're fabulous, so let's make this happen. And so she introduced me to Allison and Kathleen, and they just happened to be here. It was February, I think. It was cold in the polar vortex. You remember the polar vortex?
I do.
Yes, not with joy necessarily.
It was okay. I grew up in Alberta, so I can handle the cold.
Nothing to it, she said.
So I met them, and that turned into a wonderful thing.
So listeners, if you want to know how to get together with somebody, look around for a potato farmer, because it could be the ticket to your success.
You never know. Yeah.
So now you approached and... you guys obviously must have thought this was okay, and then you had to go through a process of hiring this guy who was, you only knew through one potato farmer in Pemberton. So how did that process go? You had to create evidence that you had something to offer.
Yeah, well, so we had an initial meeting and walked around the property a little bit, and it was still very cold. Talked about their vision for the place, and then Kathleen suggested that I write a proposal, which I don't think I'd ever done before for a job, but I got to
did
it.
Did he do
I,
okay?
Did he
do
he
okay,
did awesome.
Allison?
He did awesome. He's the best guy. We're so thrilled to have him. Every day I say, I'm so happy to have him here.
So if you've just tuned into the show, my guests today are Allison Round and Gavin Wright, who are respectively co-owner and orchard manager for North Yards Cider Company here in Salmon Arm on the old Hannah and Hannah property. So speaking of old, let's start talking about this old property, which obviously is working very well for all of you. And that's what a connection to the land is all about, is having a place where you can feel comfortable. It's 115 years old. It's not a newly owned property. It's nothing like the 10,000 years that our Indigenous friends and neighbors have been attached to the land, but it's pretty old for the settler community. I don't know if you know the history. I don't know the history myself, but obviously it was an orchard for a long time. And of course, this area was prime orchard country up until the 40s when there was a big frost, and they kept on going. So what I read in your website, I did what you were doing, Gavin. You scout out the place. 6,500 trees and 32 varietals.
Yeah.
What's all that about?
A lot. It's about a lot. it's an amazing piece of property. We couldn't have purchased a more celebrated piece of property almost anywhere in the Okanagan, in the Shuswap area. It is a dream come true to have this piece of property. The fact that it has been in one family for 115 years. And then when it did go on the market, for us opening the doors last year, when we were finally able to swing the gates open after, you know, most of the licenses had finally come through, we just had such a huge influx in volume of people who had just come just to see how it had changed, but also just to express that they were so thrilled that, you know, a developer hadn't purchased it. Although it's in the ALR, that was never going to happen, but
you know, there's always that fear.
There's always that fear, that's right. And so they were just thrilled that we were you know, planning to still sell apples, but also, you know, for us, turning it into the value-added product that we do make, our cider. People were thrilled to see it evolve in a different way, but also that was an evolution of the property that James and Harriet Hanna had hoped to see as well, was that it would be sold basically to a cidery, which was why there's so many different random apple varietals.
Really, that was part of their intent, that it one day would become a source for cider apples?
Yeah, James always says, if I were 30 years younger, we would have started our own cidery. So, yeah.
So how do you select apples to be suitable for cider? What are the properties that are important? Either of you, if you got some technical information, you can enlighten our listeners with.
Well, it's not so technical in the sense that anything goes, really. It's just the most important part on my end is the blending component. So at the end of the fermentation, we let our cider sit for 6 months to a year. And then after that, that's when the cider has had an opportunity to rebuild its complexity. And then at that point, I can take it and then blend it into something that I think is palatable and delicious.
So when apples are harvested, and then I guess the first stage is fermentation.
They get pressed. Yep. So
pressed. You squeeze the juice out.
That's right. And then
we ferment. Do you have a giant squeezer thing?
We use a Okanagan Mobile Juicer. They're out of Vernon, so they show up with a flat deck, a trailer that has just this massive juice press on the back. So it's got.
What does it look like? This massive juice press. I'm trying to visualize it.
Do you want to describe that, Gavin?
I mean, it looks a little futuristic. It is a pretty amazing setup and machine. So I mean, on the highway, it looks like a standard sort of 30-foot like white box trailer, but then they flip the sides up and it's just a whole lot of stainless steel and a whole lot of like really fancy looking stuff, and it does an amazing job.
Yeah.
So how many apples get crushed in one shot?
Well, there's a couple different numbers, say, over the course of the day, but if you're looking at the initial bin of apples that goes in, so there's a almost like an elevator lift on the back end. So the tractor, we call it the tractor dance, because there's a lot that has to happen in this short time period.
Are you on a forklift at this time?
No. Okay. We can't use the forklift. We don't have any concrete at that at where this press goes. But a bin of apples is approximately 800 pounds.
Yeah, 800 pounds. So there are four to five, we say about 4.5 bins go into 1,000 liters of juice. And so we have one of those big 1,000 liter totes, is the cube with the cage around it that people have probably seen. So that's, 4.5 bins of 800 pound bins of apples would go into making that 1,000 liters. And this machine can do 8 to 10 bins an hour. So it's quite quick.
And so
I mean it's mostly dependent on how quickly you can do the tractor dance, right, and get the next bin loaded, and then you pick up the next one, and then every four or so bins of apples there's a bin of mush that has been coming out the other end of the tractor, and then that has to be picked up and moved aside and then replaced with another one, and we compost all that mush. So That's great stuff.
So is this, I mean, I have the vision of this giant piston coming down and every little hapless apple that's under its surface is gone, crushed. Does it look like a giant piston in an internal combustion engine, or is it like a big container?
It's Yeah, so just to quickly describe the whole process, the bin of apples gets loaded into an elevator on the one end, and then it goes up the elevator, and then it tips at the top, so that whole bin tips over, and then those apples get loaded down into a water bath, so they fall down into a water bath. So they just get, it's basically an opportunity for, you know, a little bit of light soil and leaves and twigs to be able to be sorted through before it goes up another elevator. So it then goes up an elevator with the apples on these little steps of this elevator, and then it drops down into a grinder. So okay. They get ground.
Okay.
And then from that point, from the grinder, that lays it out onto a large press pad. And so it's got rollers that essentially roll the mush through, and then the juice falls to the bottom. And then there's a pump at the bottom that pumps the juice into the totes. And then while that's happening out the other side, that's where that pressed mush ends up falling off the roller pads and then into the mush bins.
So the amount, this device is obviously designed to extract a maximum amount of juice from the apples. So the mush would be fairly dry. I mean,
it's really impressive how dry it is. Yeah, I mean it's like a crumbly.
Oh, really?
You don't feel any moisture in it hardly at all. Yeah, so it is quite efficient. Yeah,
very.
And yeah. Then the mush. How do you compost that? Do you put it in big compost bins, or you put it on the soil and dig it in? What's the way that gets dealt?
We have a big pile, so just a static pile at the moment, and we I've been mixing in wood chips. So it will make sort of a woodsy compost, so it'll be a chunky sort of a compost, but that'll be really nice for the trees. That's what
And wood chips are wonderful for adding sort of bulk to the soil. Mm-hmm. They really do a good job. So you've got this juice, and now, interestingly, you don't do anything with it for 6 months.
Well, it for the first 2 to 3 weeks, it has to ferment. So we you know, at the end of a press day. A typical average press day is somewhere between 12 and 16,000 liters, which is quite a bit of juice. And we do that depending on the year. Last year we pressed quite a bit more. This year less. But last year we pressed 80,000 liters. We did that over 5 press periods over the course of, I think it ended up being 6 or 7 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It might have even been 6 last year. But yeah.
So it's quite a production process.
It is. Yeah. And you, for us, you know, tank capacity is a big deal. So the fermentation time taking between 2 to 3 weeks, and our tanks are all outside, so we are subject to weather. This was a great year for this. Because we had the longer stretch of nice weather. So that means that the fermentation temperatures overnight were, you know, fermentation builds its own temperature, but with the outside temperature being as high as it was, staying, you know, sort of in the 10s and 11, 12 degrees was great.
And fermentation is done by natural yeasts?
It can be, but we use our own yeast. I use a specific type of yeast, and that ensures that I get a full fermentation, a complete fermentation out of it.
It's predictable.
It's a predictable, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it sits.
Yeah.
After it's fermented?
That's right. We rack it off. So at the end of those 3 weeks, we rack it off because there's dead yeast cells. They've already done their job. They've now fallen to the bottom of the tank. And like anything, you don't want it just sitting around and collecting.
The lees.
The lees, that's correct.
Going the to lees. That terminology.
Oh, yeah, there's that terminology.
Yeah. I was out on the lees yesterday.
Well, that is kind of what I end up doing is once you empty the tank out and the lees are left at the bottom of the tank, you do spend a bit of time mucking about in those lees. But we get rid of it. The cider ends up going back into a tote, and now it sits for 6 months to a year.
So cider sitting for 6 months, then the magic happens?
There's always a bit of magic that's in the process, because it is a pretty unique and wonderful thing that we've even discovered how fermentation works. That's like the neat part of science, right? Because
and it's very complex and yet very simple.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, for sure. So at the end of waiting for it to become interesting again and mm-hmm. have built that complexity, that's when we start tasting it and seeing how it's tasting, and from that point on, although we have 32 different varietals on the property, some of those varietals we only have a single tree of. So those apples don't always make their way into what our core cider blends are.
So is there a dominant varietal that you use primarily? Gavin, varietals.
One of the amazing things about the former Hanna property is that the main there are 32 varietals, but as Allison said, a lot of those are sort of between one tree and 10 trees.
They're boutique trees.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is really nice to try. But at least 80% of the orchard is in Gala, Macintosh, Spartan, and Honeycrisp. And those first three, Gala, Mac, and Spartan, are three that Allison was already using in her base mix for cider. And so that was already pre-built into the property, was that these were the main apples that we had, which is wonderful. And now the Honeycrisp we didn't use previously, but have been using as a sweetening juice, and it's been
quite, very sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is it is also, Allison formerly used Ambrosia.
Correct.
And Honeycrisp is very sweet, but also has, in my opinion, a nicer flavor because it has a little bit more complexity. It does have a little more tannins, I think, and a little more of a floral kind of thing going on. But obviously that changes the science of the blend, and so then we have to figure that out, right? I mean, as an apple, I think the flavor's amazing, I think.
Yeah, apples are good. We like apples.
Yeah, we do.
Allison, how do you know, you said when after 6 months this it's ready, it's regained its complexity. How do you know that? Do you stick a little jug into a vast array of apple juice?
Basically, yes, we do, yeah. We take little glasses, we dip them in the top of the totes and pull little samples out. And we just kind of mix them together and then see if I think that the blend works. But a lot of the time it's what I'm testing for in the individual varietals is to see whether or not, like, my brain kind of takes it like a puzzle piece and I put it together based on its pH, so the acidity level of the varietals. So that's part of the blending process. So sometimes, the Gala can be, I would describe it as quite a chill flavor. It's very chill. But Granny Smith, we all know, is very tart, and
Does chill mean mild? Does chill mean mild?
Yeah.
Okay, just because I'm old enough to use chill to mean when
perfect.
You're cold.
No, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, as a mild flavor, thank you. Yeah.
And then the Spartan sort of spices that up with this tartness.
It just depends on what the apples are doing. Sometimes I'm really surprised to find that a Spartan can be really mild, and that's where, I don't go based on a perfect recipe every single time, so...
This is the art of cider
making. It is, and that's what makes craft so exciting, is that it is different every time. We're not a large cider company. You can try my semi-dry or my dry. You can open up a can this year or next year, it's going to taste a little bit different. I guarantee that. But I think that's kind of exciting, right? Like, you
For
don't
sure.
expect a good bottle of wine to taste... the identical to what the previous year did. That's the beauty of what the weather is doing to the apples.
And seeing
or
a lawn that has a couple of weeds in it makes you think it's probably going to be healthy.
Yeah, right.
You're growing whatever happens to come by.
Yeah.
So this has led at, so you've found that the juice, it's fermented, it's now regained some complexity, and then you start doing the blending?
I do, yeah.
And how does that happen? You have a big vat and you dump it into another big vat?
We just do it in small little glasses, actually. So although we have huge volumes, obviously, mm-hmm. sitting around, I just do it in small little tasters. Funny story, the first time we ever did this, when Kathleen and I were about to open up the cidery in Squamish, she might laugh to know that I'm going to tell this on the radio, but she was sitting in her office at her law firm, and I rolled up with four jars of cider, each of the four different varietals, and I basically, like a mad scientist, mixed them in front of her and kept handing her the glass saying, is this one good? What do you think about the taste of this one? Because Kathleen has a really great palate, and when you're first starting out, I don't trust myself to make sure that I think that it's great, but with her, I could hand all those weird mixtures over, and she helped me create the initial blend way back, 4 years ago. So, yeah.
And she didn't have to go home and sleep it
off. No, she didn't have to. No, no.
You didn't give her that much.
No, not that much. No, she still had to work.
It's interesting. John Robbins is the scion of the Baskin-Robbins ice cream empire, and he was actually the taster for all their new flavors, which is one reason he became a vegan and moved away from the family circle and started a farm on Vancouver Island that was vegetables only. But in this case, you do taste your own product. So you now have, after you've blended everything together, then do you say, okay, this is the right combination, and make a big batch?
We blend, yeah, the big batch that I blend ends up being 2,000 liters only, which probably sounds like a lot for anyone sitting at home, but for us, it's actually a really small, it's a small amount comparative, to any large cidery or brewery, even microbreweries out there. They do larger batches than we do for the most part. For us, we do it into a 2,000 liter bright tank, and then from that point on, that's when we add carbonation.
And there's a point where you're also adding other things, because right now there are six different products, if mm-hmm. you want to call them, or blends. Product sounds a bit crass, but blends that come out of your cidery. They've got interesting names, but also they obviously have descriptive names. So there's dry, and yep. that's, you let all the sugars get consumed by the yeast.
Yep, fermented right to dry. So all the sugars have been fermented.
And then
fermented
semi-dry,
out.
You add back in some sweetness.
Yep, a little bit of Honeycrisp juice is we're back sweetening right now. So yeah.
Was that Gavin's idea? He likes Honeycrisp.
It was more just based on the fact that, I'd initially started with Ambrosia, and because we have no Ambrosia on the property, we, just changed course and went to Honeycrisp.
And last year we had, 100 bins of Honeycrisp, yeah. So we're like, well, we got to do something with this stuff, right?
Yeah, better do something.
Now, I'm just going to name the other products because we got just a few minutes left in the show, but one is grapefruit with hops, and you've designated that as the beer drinker's transition beverage.
Yeah, the gateway cider for a beer drinker.
The gateway cider, all you beer drinkers, here's how you get into your cider phase. Raspberry, which has some raspberry juice added to it.
Correct.
Cranberry orange. I wasn't quite sure how that one happened, but it was obviously got cranberry and orange something in it.
Cranberry is a cranberry juice, and then we actually peel oranges and take the rind, put them in a bag, and let it sit in the cranberry cider for 2 days. And the idea behind that is just like a tea, the oils infuse themselves sure. in the cider, and you get something.
Orange.
yeah, more interesting than just, say, a cranberry.
And type. Pineapple mint?
Yeah, that was a weird brainchild of mine, just sort of like a cider mojito, but I call it a Saturday, Sunday morning kind of cider.
the creativity that goes into names of beverages is sometimes quite astonishing.
It's true, yeah.
And then blackberry has some blackberry juice.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
So we're coming to the end of the show, and I wanted maybe if you each of you take 30 seconds just to say what your goals are. I mean, obviously they're conjunctive, they're goals that you share. But where is this going to go, do you think? I mean, it doesn't have to go anywhere. It can just stay where it is right now because obviously it's doing well and you're happy with it.
We would love to grow it. We've got so many apples on our property. I'd love to be able to see more people drinking, a premium craft cider that is a clean product, tastes delicious. We also with the property just have a really fun opportunity to invite people to our property that there is a lot to experience.
You have tours and people can stay on the property as
That's
guests.
Right.
And Gavin, you've been involved with the organic movement. It's going to be certified in another year or so as organic.
Yeah, we're in our final year of transition now for the land, so it will be.
It'll be done.
It'll be done by next summer, yeah.
I've been talking to Allison Round and Gavin Wright from North Yard Cider, and we've had a wonderful time talking about a beverage that many people are becoming very interested in. Thank you to both of you for coming into our show. It's been a wonderful time having you here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.